Matos Mase, double parsha this week. This is the last of the Sefer Bamidbar, that's correct. This is the final two parshios in the fourth of our five books of Sefer Bamidbar, as the Jews are preparing to enter the land of Israel, right before the final farewell speeches that Moshe will give them starting next week with Sefer Devarim. Now we are also one full week into the three-week period, known as the three-week period, in which we have dedicated to the mourning of the destruction of the two temples in Jerusalem, and the fact that we've been exiled from the land of Israel, living here in this land of the United States, in Atlanta. And we mourn that fact over a three-week period every summer. We're a full week in. Last week was the fast of the 17th of Tammuz. 2 weeks from today will be Tisha B'Av. So, as I did last week, I'd like to also focus this week, combine the Parsha together with the time period that we're in. And it's actually of note, this week's Parsha has one of the fundamental psukim, one of the fundamental verses, which is at the center of a storm of rabbinic debates regarding the land of Israel and the mitzvah to inherit and dwell within it. So I thought that even though that's not directly related to the mourning, but it is very much related to the entire issue that should be forefront in our mind in this period. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. I couldn't help to have such a verse in this week's parasha during this time period and not discuss it. I just thought it was just totally inappropriate. So we'll tackle that. So we'll do the context as I like to do. We'll go back over the psukim surrounding this particular verse. And we will discover, of course, a dispute between Rashi and Ramban. Track, you guys are such great students of mine. Just wonderful students of this class, knowing exactly what's coming. We will find a classic dispute between Rashi and Ramban and massive ramifications. It will seem like massive ramifications by the end of the hour. I think it will be a little bit less than what it sounds like regarding that. So the verses that I would like to discuss start on page 920. This is in the middle of the second of the 2 weeks parshas, Parshas Maaseh. 920, 921. So, just to put it in context, if you'll flip back one page to page 918, you'll see the beginning of the parasha. That's the beginning of Parshas Maaseh, and as the word Maaseh means journeys, the Torah begins by listing all the places that the Jews have traveled in. We are now at the end of the 40 years. We are on the verge, on the cusp of entering into the land of Israel. The entire Sefer Devarim is over a few weeks period in which Moshe gives a number of farewell speeches, so to speak. We are at the end of a 40-year period, and the Torah at this point lists and enumerates all the places that the Jews have been in. That's how the Torah begins, 42 different places that they've encamped. And that's the long list, which you'll see. You could just skim it with your eyes, going through that whole first page, 918 and 919, continuing to the bottom of page 920 and 921. 50 verses, just a long list of describing all the places that they've been, a few references to incidents which have taken place, but that's the context of where we are. Following this list, the Torah has what we're now going to study, about 7 or 8 psukim, beginning with verse 50 till the end of the chapter on the following page, in which we are given a command to go into the land of Israel, wipe out the nations that live there, and eventually settle it ourselves. And we will work through this to uncover some interesting facts. Okay, so here we go. That's the context of where we are at. So let's start with verse 50. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe ve'arvos Moav al Yarden Yericho le'mor. So Hashem speaks to Moshe in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Yericho, saying. So the context, where is this being said? Now these are famous places, Yericho. What's so famous about Yericho?
Joshua.
That was the very first place that the Jewish people are about to conquer when they enter into the land of Israel, on the banks of the Jordan River, where we had the miraculous splitting of the Jordan River. So we are literally on the banks of the Jordan River, overlooking Yericho, on our way into the land of Israel, right before we've gotten in. It's been 40 years, and here is the command that Hashem tells the Jewish people as we stand there preparing to move in. So Hashem says to Moshe as follows, Dabero b'nei Yisrael va'amarto aleihem. Speak to the Jewish people, and you'll say to them as follows, Ki atem ovrim es hayarden el eretz Canaan. When you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, what will you do when you cross the Jordan into the land of that? That's what we're ready to do, right? We're ready to cross over. What should we do when we cross over? says the Torah, V'horashtem es kol yoshvei ha'oretz mipneichem. Now this V'horashtem, that first word of the verse, pay careful attention to it, because we will see it again momentarily. That word, so here, as Rashi points out, and everyone agrees to, means drive out. Horashtem is an interesting word in Hebrew. It has a couple of different meanings. The main word, for anyone who is as familiarity with the Hebrew language, when you hear the word V'horashtem, what's the word that sounds most similar to?
Yerusha.
A Yerusha. What's a Yerusha?
Inheritance.
That's the word that we're all familiar with. A person gets a Yerusha. They get an inheritance. A family member passes on, be it anyone, or not even a family member, a friend passes on. There's such a thing called an inheritance, and we all inherit from the generations before us, and the word for that is Yerusha. That's what that word means, an inheritance. It has an alternate meaning, which we have here in this pasuk. V'horashtem es kol yoshvei ha'aretz. Not to inherit, but to drive out the inhabitants of the land. We are commanded as we cross over into the Jordan to drive out those inhabitants of the land. V'ibadetem es kol maskio. Some destroy their stones that they use for bowing down purposes. V'es kol salmei masechosom ta'abedu. The images you shall destroy. V'es kol bamosom tashmidu. And all their high places you shall demolish. So, four different ways of describing basically the same concept. When you enter into the land, annihilate the nations that are currently living there. This is your land, and they are there now. Knock them out, destroy their bowing down stones, destroy their high places, destroy their places of worship, demolish them, a commandment to rid the land of Eretz Yisrael, rid the land of Israel of all of those forces of idolatry.
And the people too.
And the people too. And is correct. There is a specific commandment, as that's what we're going to be studying about, that the seven nations which lived in the land of Israel, that they should be destroyed in the war of conquest for the land of Israel. That is correct. Now, verse 53, Nun Gimel, repeats that same phrase again. V'horashtem es ha'oretz v'shavtem ba. Now, it's going to be tricky because you're going to be looking in the article English, as I see all of you are doing right now, which is fair. And we will see, there's going to be a dispute between Rashi and the Ramban exactly how to translate this phrase. But if we were to translate that same phrase, V'horashtem es ha'oretz v'shavtem ba, it would sound like, let's compare these two phrases. The first phrase in the verse before that said, V'horashtem es kol yoshvei ha'aretz. The Yoshvei Haaretz means the inhabitants of the land, which is why we translate that as, well, you don't inherit a person. So if the word V'horashtem is the verb, and the object of that verb are the people who dwell there, that would lend itself that the translation of the word V'horashtem would be, drive them out. Drive out the people who live there, because you can't inherit people. That doesn't work. So it must mean, if that which I'm doing the action to are people, it must mean, drive them out. The second phrase in verse 53 says, V'horashtem es ha'aretz, the land. So you can't drive out the land. That must mean, how should we translate this phrase?
Inherit
the land, which is how Archgold translates this as, you shall possess the land and you shall settle it. That's fair, everyone with me? Was that confusing?
Mm-hmm.
Slow it down? Should I go over that one more time? Talk slower, but that was clear. This is going to be the fundamental point in which we're going to be discussing. So I want to make sure that came out clear. In terms of the fact we have two consecutive verses which begin with the same phrase, except one time it's referring to the inhabitants of the land, the second time it's referring to the land itself. And so it would sound like there would be two different verbs. What the first one would mean, drive out the inhabitants, and then inherit the land, as our scroll seems to translate that. But let's continue in verse 53. V'horashtem es ha'aretz v'shavtem ba. So possess the land and you shall settle in it. Ki lochem nosati es ha'aretz l'reshes oso. Because for you I have given this land to settle it. The beautiful verse in which Hashem says, take possession of this land, settle this land. I have given this land to you to settle. Continues the Torah, you shall then give this land as an inheritance to by lot to your families, meaning you'll divide up all the families that are going in, divide up the land, and give each family a portion of the land. L'rav tarbu es nachalaso, for the larger families they will get a larger portion. V'lema'at tamid es nachalaso, the smaller families will get less. And so on and so forth. Let's skip to verse 55. V'im lo sorishu es yoshvei ha'oretz mipneichem. But if you do not expel, if you do not destroy and drive out the inhabitants that are there now, because remember that was the initial if statement, going back to the very top of the page, you're about to cross over, and what should you do when you cross over? Drive out the inhabitants, and you'll inherit the land. If you do not drive out the inhabitants, says the Torah, the hayo asher tosiru mehem laf mehem l'sikim be'einechem v'litzninim b'tzideichem. Poetic phrase, says the Torah, they will, those of them whom you leave shall be like pins in your eyes and a surrounding barrier of thorns in your sides. V'tzoru eschem, they will harass you al ha'oretz asher atem yoshuvim bo. They will cause untold problems, pain and suffering if you allow them to remain in your land. And then worse than that, says Hashem, the hayah kasher dimisi la'asos lahem, that which I have meant to do to them, e'eseh lochem, I will do to you. Frightening verse. So you have this command, you're about to cross over into the land, there are seven nations there, they're living in my house, says Hashem. This is my world, remember? I created it. This is my land within my world, and I want to give it to you. You are charged to go in, clear it out entirely. If you don't clear it out, you will find them to be thorns in your sides and pins in your eyes. And worse than that, Hashem says, than all those things which I've intended to do to them, if you don't take care of your job, your business, I will do it to you.
That God
created. 100%. Now that is a question which is discussed. I saw in one of the books that I was looking at in preparation for this class. It is only a divine command. As we have, you have certain instances in which we are required to annihilate and to kill other people because they don't fit into the divine scheme of things. And it's a difficult concept to grasp, and I think it's worthy of a much greater discussion than I'm going to give it now because it's not the topic that I want to focus on. But it is a very important point that there are instances in which we are commanded to kill, this being one of the primary ones. The nation of Amalek is another one in which we are required to kill, and it is a difficult concept for us because we are living in a time now where that command does not apply. And so all that we have are arguments against the Arab world who are claiming religious beliefs and killing in the name of God and saying how ridiculous that is and how absurd that is and how insane that's caused. And yet we find there are instances where we have the same thing. So it's not like they made up that concept. The instances in which they use it, they've taken that in and done horrors with it. But there are instances in which we are as well commanded to kill, and it's worthy of a much larger discussion than I'm giving it today. That there are certain things that need to be that way. Just like in the, there are, I don't know, we can have lots of different parables, but just like there are cancers in a body which need to be annihilated for the survival of the body, in which we will put poison into our bodies, literally, to kill, because we recognize such a horrible, whatever that is, left alone will actually destroy the rest of a healthy body. So there are times in which we need to destroy parts of our own body for the salvation of the entirety of the whole. Just a simple parable. So there are forces in the world, evil, negative, anti-God forces in the world, where if they retain that status, will actually destroy the survival of the entire world purpose. Now, unlike a cancer, those people have the choice normally in terms of how they want to live a life. In certain divine, they've decided to go a certain way, they believe in a certain thing, it's anti-God, and we cannot fulfill our mission in the world, God's mission in the world, while they're there. It just doesn't exist. And they threaten the world's purpose, and therefore, I just want to throw that out there, it deserves a much larger discussion. But it is a fine point and requires further study. Yeah?
So, So were they bad people or not?
They were idolatrous people to the core.
Okay.
When you say the word bad, bad is a general, what does bad mean? What is that?
To make us say feel better.
Right. In other words, they were not bad. They might have been nice people. Right. They might have been nice people. They might have taken care of their families and cared for their children. But they were idolatrous to the core, to the point where it would have not allowed the world's purpose to come to its fruition if their existence remained in Eretz Yisrael. They might have been evil people also. I don't know. The Torah's description of the reason to destroy them is that it was the idolatry in it. Which again, part of the reason why we don't appreciate this is because we don't have real idolatry in the world anymore. Talmud already discusses that the sages prayed for and abolished the desire for idolatry. So that we discuss this ever in this group? It's a very important piece of the Talmud. We have lots of desires in life, be it for money, for wealth, for all sorts of, for honor, well, lots of things which we want and we think about a lot and we desire. And one of those things is not idolatry. We rarely have a desire to worship the sun. It almost sounds odd to us. We read stories in Tanakh and in other nations of idolatrous practices, and we are sort of struggling just for what's the mindset? So the Talmud says that idolatry was so rampant and so horrible, destroying the Jewish people. And as you read through Tanakh, one after another, kings, priests, high levels of Jewish peoples were falling prey to it. So they got together and the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, got together and prayed that the desire for idolatry, the Yetzer Hara for idolatry, should be abolished. And they were answered. And God, so to speak, abolished the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. So the way that we look at idolatry now is what it would mean to look at something without having Yetzer Hara for it. No desire. It's silly. So the Talmud continues and says, the sages thought that this worked so well that they said, let's abolish the desire for adulterous relationships, illicit relationships between men and women. Because that's also ravaging our people. So let's abolish that. So they prayed for that as well. And God answered and said, no problem. Abolish the Yetzer Hara for sexual relations. Talmud says, a week later, there was not a single egg, not even a chicken's egg, to be found in the entire land of Israel. So the sages said, this isn't going to work. This is not going to work. Because we abolished there's no drive for any level of intimacy. It was just abolished. So they said, forget it. That we'll have that back and we'll deal with it, but at least abolish the desire for incestuous relationships between father and mother, a child and sisters and siblings, and abolish that. So that was where the Talmud leaves off, which is why in life, that's what we have today. There's very little desire between a brother and his sister, or a son for his mother, or father. That's out of the norm. Psychological, you could institutionalize somebody. There's a diagnosis for that. It's just not normal behavior. But general man-woman relations, that's still a problem we have. And that's where the sages left it. So idolatry was abolished. We have no Yetzer Hara for that. But for man-woman relationships, we do, just not within our close family unit. But in any case, that's what it's like not to have an idolatry. So going back to the point where this stemmed from, we don't appreciate what it was like to have idolatry in the nation which surrounded us. We don't appreciate what it was like, what a threat it was to the Jewish people, what a threat it was to the continuation of belief in a single God when the nations around you were idolatrous, because we just were so far removed from that. It's just not something we deal with. So it's hard to appreciate it, but that's, again, even longer than I wanted to spend in America. That's that discussion. Still have a question?
I was going to say that it also justifies, because the whole purpose of Yetziat Mitzrayim, this is the culmination of the Yetziat Mitzrayim. So God's plan for the Jewish people was to live a holy life in a holy land, and so whatever obstacles were, I mean, that's how I understand it.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so that's the backdrop. So now we have the psukim and we have the verses. The question on the table that Rashi and the Ramban are going to grapple with is, how do we understand Is there a commandment here? Is there a requirement to dwell in the land of Israel? Do we clearly have a requirement to abolish those who live in the land of Israel? Go in there, annihilate them, demolish them, destroy them, settle the land. How do we understand that second verse, verse 53, of that second word of the Horashtem es ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba, to inherit this land and settle in it? Now, let's start with Rashi's interpretation. It's going to be a little bit tricky. It's a short Rashi, and I will read it in Sanskrit. I'll translate it to understand Rashi's interpretation of the pasuk. Now again, just go one last time. So in verse 52, the word of the Horashtem on the top of our page meant clearly drive out. How do we know that the word of the Horashtem on the top of our page, verse 52, means to drive out? Because the object of that verb is the phrase Yoshvei Haaretz, the inhabitants of the land. So if the object of the phrase is the inhabitants, then the verb must be drive them out, because it could not possibly mean inherit the inhabitants of the land. It must mean drive out the inhabitants of the land. The second pasuk that we have in verse 53 says V'horashtem es haaretz v'shaftem bav, where the object is the land itself. Now what Rashi is going to do,
the same word,
Yashvei
and Shafta.
Well,
a lot of Western people like that.
Yes.
They have opposite meanings.
Sometimes have. Well, here
it's almost like that.
Different opposites sometimes. Always usually somehow connected, but yeah. So listen to a Rashi on verse 53. Says Rashi, it's five lines down in the first column in Rashi if you want to follow it inside. Rashi says as follows, the Horashtem Esa Aretz, the Horashtem Osa Mi Yoshveha. So he adds in a phrase that the Torah didn't say, drive out the land from its inhabitants. He adds a phrase, so instead of making it into a phrase of inherit the land, he wants to maintain the consistency of the phraseology. And just like V'horashtem in the verse before meant drive out the inhabitants, as the Torah says explicitly, so he interprets the second phrase of V'horashtem es ha'aretz doesn't mean inherit the land, it means drive out those who inhabit the land, the oz, and then the shaftem ba. Continuing the verse, the phrase in the pasuk, you will dwell it. Meaning the oz, tuchlo lehis kayem ba. So it's a conditional statement. If you drive out the inhabitants of the land, then you will be able to settle and inherit this land. But if you don't drive out the inhabitants of the land, lo sucho lehis kayem ba, you will not be able to dwell in it. So in effect, what Rashi has done, for those who didn't follow the intricate way of how he did that, is he maintained the same translation of the Horashim from the previous verse. So that the Torah is saying, when you get to the land of Israel, verse 52, drive out the inhabitants, drive out their stones, drive out their high places, destroy their places of worship. V'horashtem es ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba. And if you are successful in driving them out, so that the phrase of v'horashtem means the same thing as it did before, if you will drive them out, then you will be able to settle the land. So that in Rashi's interpretation, there is no commandment here to settle the land of Israel. The phrase in the Torah is saying, when you go over there, drive them out. If you will successfully drive them out, you will be able to have a land in which to inherit. But there is no directive in this pasuk saying, go possess the land and inheritance. That's not the directive of the verse. The verse means, drive out the inhabitants of the land, thereby allowing yourself the ability to have an open land which you'll be able to settle. Not a mitzvah to settle, but that you'll be able to settle. So that there's a conditional statement. Now, I might not be clear what I'm saying, as I see some quizzical faces. I think that will be clear if we contrast that to the way that the Ramban reads this pasuk. So let's attempt that, and then we'll go back and summarize what we have as far as the two different approaches. Now, I photocopied the Ramban. It's a couple lines in Hebrew. I'm not sure anyone's interested in me reading it actually inside or just saying it over. I'm happy to do either one. Preferences?
Oh,
pass them around. You can see it around. I'll translate everything. I think there are only 10 copies. I think a little bit more than that in here. I have the actual original here, so I could read it out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Ramban reads this verse as follows. That's the verse. Inherit this land, and you will acquire. Now, I read that translated as he's going to. Says the Ramban, starting from his phrase, Al da'ati, in my mind, zu mitzvas asehi. This is a mitzvah asehi. This is a positive commandment in the Torah to inherit the land and settle it. Yitzava osam, Hashem commanded the Jewish people, Shiyoshu ba'aretz, to dwell and settle this land, the Yirshu osa, to inherit it, Kihu natana lohem, because He has given it to them. So this is a directive of, the verse 52 would be a verse saying, drive out the inhabitants that are there now. And verse 53 is a commandment, and then you go settle it, and make it yours as its inheritance, because I have given it to you. V'lo yim'osu v'nachlos Hashem. Beautiful language. Do not be disgusted. Do not be repulsed by this inheritance of Hashem. Do not be repulsed by it, but then you have a mitzvah to go into it, to settle it, and to live in it. V'ilu ya'ale al-daitam. And if it would even enter into the minds of the Jewish people, l'oleches v'lichboish eretz shinar, to go and conquer the land of Shinar, or Eretz Ashur, or the land of Ashur, Vizulosan, or any other land, or with Yashav Sham, if it would enter into their minds to go any other place and conquer that land to settle it, Ya'avru al mitzvah Hashem. They will have violated the mitzvah of Hashem, who has commanded it specifically, enter into this land, dwell in it, and settle it. And that which the sages talk in such glowing terms about the land of Israel and about its special qualities and its nature and how it's different from every other land on the planet, and how it is forbidden for one to leave the land of Israel, I'll read that inside. And we'll get to that in a moment. And they judged a woman or a man as a literally a rebellious spouse. Another. I'll do that right now. We'll just start. What are you referring to? You're referring to the following concepts. So you have the sages talk about Eretz Israel in glowing terms. They talk that it's also to leave. It's forbidden to leave the land of Israel. And now what the Ramban is referring to is a Mishnah at the end of Maseches Ksuvos, the tractate Ksuvos, which discusses marital issues, the responsibilities of a husband to wife and a wife to her husband. So at the very end of this tractate, the Mishnah writes, Hakol ma'alin le'Eretz Israel. Everybody can go up to the land of Israel. So the Gemara explains, what does that phrase mean, that everybody can go up to the land of Israel? So the Gemara explains that if a couple lives outside the land of Israel, and the husband says, let's go to Israel, and the wife says, I'm not leaving. So then she forfeits her right to her ksuva, and he has grounds to divorce her without having to pay the ksuva, which he's otherwise responsible for, which is a significant sum of money. A ksuva is close to the $20,000-$25,000 range in today's terms. She forgoes that by refusing to go to the land of Israel. And if she says, let's go to Israel, and he says, so then he is obligated to pay her ksuva, and she has the right to walk out of the marriage. Normally she couldn't do that and get her ksuva. She walks out of the marriage, and you're forfeiting her. She has a right, and then she gets her ksuva, her payment, and she can go to the land of Israel. And if they live in Israel, and he says, we're staying here, this is great, and she says, I'm out of here. So it's the same thing. If you're out of there, you forfeit your right to your ksuva. You cannot force your husband to leave the land of Israel. Same thing the opposite way. If he says he wants to leave, he has to pay her ksuva, she has the right to stay. Now, how this works out in practical terms, it's a separate discussion. This is the starting point. This is a starting point in which the sages are describing in the context of what's considered a contractual or a lack of fulfillment of the marriage pact. So there are certain things that either spouse can do which forfeits their right. You're not living up to the deals of the marriage. So the sages went through and said those deals are off when it comes to living in the land of Israel. And either spouse has a right to say, that's where I'm going, and there's nothing you can do to stop me, and I'm not in violation of anything in so doing. So the Ramban brings this as an example. Where is this coming from? How is that possible that you can break a marriage, so to speak, over the idea of living in the land of Israel. So the Ramban continues and says, all of these principles, the fact that the sages, the way that they talk about the land of Israel, the fact that they say it's forbidden to leave the land of Israel, the fact that a wife or a husband can force the other to go with them to the land of Israel, Bikan nitztavinu b'mitzvah hazu. It's this verse, says the Ramban. This verse of the horashtem es kol yosh es ha'oretz, inherit the land, the shaftem ba, and dwell in it. This is the verse in which Hashem is commanding the Jewish people a mitzvah, a positive commandment to settle and dwell in the land of Israel. Says the Ramban, that's the source for all the statements that the sages make about the land of Israel. This is one of the mitzvahs. So when you count to 613 mitzvahs, says the Ramban, this should be in there, the mitzvah to settle and dwell in the land of Israel. And then he quotes Rashi, says Rashi didn't learn this way. Rashi did not understand this to be the case, as we learned a few moments ago. Rashi learns this as being a conditional statement. It doesn't mean inherit the land and settle it. It means kick out those who live in the land, and in so doing, you will find yourself an open place to live. So in Rashi's count, he will not list this as one of the 613 commandments, because there is not a commandment to settle the land of Israel. This verse is a statement of the other translation of the Horashtim. Drive out the inhabitants, and you'll be able to live. In the Ramban, it's inherit the land, and you'll be able to live, as a directive, as a commandment, as a positive mitzvah. That all stems from how they translate the word Vahorashtem in understanding this particular verse. There are various scriptural proofs to Rashi that I've seen in terms of, I don't want to bore you with the technical details of the wording of the Pasuk, but I've seen in terms of, from within the context of the Pasuk, both the Maharal and the Or HaChaim, one of the classic commentators, all bring proofs from the text to Rashi's interpretation of this particular verse. Now, there are other verses which one can point to if one didn't have this one, but in this particular verse, they all point to Rashi. But the Ramban brings various Gemaras and other statements in Chazal to back his position, which we'll see a couple in a moment or two, that this is in fact a positive mitzvah, one of the commandments to dwell and settle in the land of Israel.
So, according to Rashi, what would be the consequence of someone not wanting to cross the Yarden and not go through that?
They would be in violation, meaning at that time, member of the Jewish people in that time would be in violation of the commandment to annihilate the nations. He would not be in violation of the commandment to settle, because they're, according to his interpretation of this passage, that was not an explicit directive.
Did they have to go and do the entire land and wipe out everything?
Yeah.
That was their job.
Yes. Took 14 years. Took 14 years, well, 7 years of conquest and then 7 years of dividing it up. So the wars took 7 years. Not a big piece of land, remember. Took 7 years to entirely to work through from top to bottom and conquer the land of Israel. You should know, by the way, just in reference to your question as well, the very first Rashi in Chumash, very first in the beginning of Bereishis, says, why do we need to know that Hashem created heaven and earth? Why couldn't we just start the Chumash with the commandments? Start with the beginning of Sefer Shmos, where we begin to actually have commandments. And Rashi right there, the very first Rashi, way back when, because when the Jews will enter the land of Israel, and the nations of the world will say, this is our land, and you're a bunch of thieves coming in here and conquering this land, we'll say, no. This is God's world. Don't you remember the phrase Bereishis Baro Elokim Es Hashamayim V'Es Haaretz? God created heaven and earth. He decided to give it to you until this year, and He's decided from here on out we're taking over. And that he quotes from the sages that the whole reason why we have the beginning stories of creation, even though there's no laws involved over there, we don't need to know that as far as how to live our lives as observant Jews, is there so that we should be justified as we go in and conquer the land, take it over as ours, that we're backed by a divine source, that I created this whole project anyway, and I have the right to say who wants it and when, and who'll get it. So that is all part of that. Okay. The Rambam, Maimonides, has, as you know, a count of the mitzvahs of the Torah. 613 mitzvahs, which is based on a Gemara at the end of the tractate Makos, and he lists them. What are the 613 mitzvahs? So if you go through the 613, there's a number of them that you will not find. number of those which we would have thought should be included which are not. And one of the classic mitzvahs which is not found in the 613 is a mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel. So that Maimonides, when he counts the 613 mitzvahs, does not list anywhere in there that living in the land of Israel is the fulfillment of the positive mitzvah. Just not included. The Ramban, Nachmanides, wrote an addendum to the Rambam Sefer, to the Maimonides book of accounts of the 613 mitzvahs, and he called it, it's not a full book, it's a little pamphlet, he called it the mitzvahs that the Rambam forgot to count. That's what he called it. Yeah, that's what he called it. That's what he called it. The mitzvahs that he forgot to count. And he has, 25 mitzvahs that the Rambam didn't count. And this is great discussion topics as to why Maimonides would count something, why he wouldn't, what are the rules that Maimonides used to count the mitzvah or not to count the mitzvah, and how did that manifest itself and how he eventually counted certain mitzvahs, like just for example, Shabbos. So how many mitzvahs would you count as keeping Shabbos? I mean, there are thousands of laws involved in Shabbos, thousands of laws. So do you say it's one mitzvah? The mitzvah of keeping Shabbos, it's one mitzvah. Or do you say, I don't know, maybe it's like two mitzvahs. There's the mitzvah of making kiddush, there's the mitzvah of not doing work. How many do you count? So there are rules for these things. And the Rambam wrote this book, so the first 100 pages or so, just to show you how amazing this is. Here it is. This page is the first mitzvah that he lists. All of this are the rules that he used to count, come to his conclusion. So it's 206 pages of rules, of principles, how I counted what I counted as one mitzvah, what I counted as two mitzvahs, what qualifies as a mitzvah to come to 613. So it's almost half the book were the rules. So as you can imagine, the Ramban, Nachmanides, didn't agree with every rule, and therefore that manifested itself in various mitzvahs that the Ramban counted that the Rambam didn't count. In any case, the fourth in the Ramban's list of mitzvahs that the Rambam forgot to count is this mitzvah of living in the land of Israel, because Maimonides doesn't count it. It would seemingly be that Maimonides understood the verse the way Rashi did, that this was not a directive of you must settle the land of Israel, but it was a directive to annihilate the people there, and in so doing you will have yourself a place to live. But he does not count it as a specific mitzvah. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, takes issue with that, and says, and the fourth, he has a list of 20 things, the fourth mitzvah that the Rambam forgot to count is the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. And he goes through a lengthy discussion, proving from various sources that it is in fact a positive commandment. We are commanded until this day. Some want to suggest that the reason why Maimonides didn't count it is because it doesn't apply today, since we don't have the king and we don't all live there and Mashiach hasn't come. Various reasons why it wouldn't apply. So the Ramban says that's not true. This is a mitzvah which applies in every generation. Anyone who lives in the land of Israel is fulfilling a positive commandment to live in the land of Israel, and it should be counted as part. And I just want to read to you his language at the end of all of his proofs, and he goes through various proofs from passages in the Talmud and various verses in the Chumash to defend his position. He writes, Im kein hi mitzvos asei ledoros. This is a positive commandment for every generation. Mischayiv ko yochid mimenu. Every individual is responsible in this mitzvah. Vafilu bizman golos. Even during the time period of exile, this mitzvah applies to dwell and settle in the land of Israel, as you find in many places. And then he quotes, he concludes his piece with the following story from the sages in a medrash. The medrash records a mice, an incident with Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, a couple of sages, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Masya and Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Nathan. Five sages were together. They were living in the land of Israel and they had left. They got to a certain city which was outside the land of Israel. And all of a sudden it dawned upon them that they had just left the land of Israel and were no longer in that special land. They were now in Chutz La'aretz, outside the land of the diaspora. They raised up their eyes. And their tears poured from their eyes. They ripped their clothing. They read this verse, which is our verse from this week's parsha, V'yirashta V'yishavta, that you should inherit it and you should dwell in it. Ve'amru yeshivas eretz Yisrael shkula keneged kol ha-mitzvah shebetorah. That living in the land of Israel is equivalent to all of the mitzvahs in the Torah. And that's his conclusion for his discussion, that is a mitzvah, and these five sages were crying over the fact that they had just left, and he brings that as a proof to the fact that this is in fact a positive commandment which applies in all generations. Yeah?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
At some point, I think I learned that when you have this wording that the whole thing starts with, the bear Hashem al Moshe Lemor, that the Lemor always indicates that it's for all time.
It's correct. The question is, what's for all time? The wiping out of the seven nations? That
well,
everyone's adoring.
Say for all time that we're to live there.
Well, so that's the way Rashi interprets the verse. What the statement was, annihilate the nations so that you can live there. But the commandment part, which would apply all time, would be wipe out all the nations that live there. It's that so that you may dwell there. It wouldn't be in this particular. There are other verses we could talk about, but in this particular verse wouldn't be part of the commandment. Wouldn't be part of the commandment. Now, I just need to leave you with one further thought before we conclude. I really didn't even do this topic justice. This is a massive topic as to whether or not living in the land of Israel is a mitzvah or is not a mitzvah, because that was of great importance. Like, what are we supposed to do? So, in the Ramban's opinion, it's clearly a mitzvah. The Rambam doesn't count it. And Rashi's interpretation in this particular verse also would not make it seem like it is a positive commandment. There is a tremendous amount of literature working through the opinion of the Rambam. How does he view this mitzvah of living? There are so many verses which talk about it. So I want to share with you the opinion of the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer lived in the late 1800s. He was a brilliant. He was the head of. I can't even pronounce the name of the city. I looked it up. I'm not even going to try. I just embarrassed myself. But a vast number of books. So he has a very famous response in his understanding of the opinion of the Rambam, who does not count this mitzvah. And it goes as follows. He learns the overwhelming majority of authorities do agree with the Ramban that it is in fact a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And he expresses the Rambam, Maimonides, who does not count it as follows. He bases himself on another discussion on the construction of the tabernacle. I'm going to switch gears for a second, talk about the building of the tabernacle, and then we'll tie it back in. In discussing how many mitzvahs are there in building the tabernacle, the Ramban and the Rambam, Maimonides and Nachmanides, argue about the construction of the ark, the Aron, whether or not that's a specific mitzvah involved in the construction of the tabernacle. Maimonides is of the opinion that it is not a mitzvah. There is not a specific mitzvah for the building of the ark. The Avnei Nezer explains the reason for that based on what the Rambam himself writes, is because the entire purpose of the Mishkan, the entire purpose of the tabernacle and the Beis HaMikdash, is for the purpose of the divine presence resting and being part of that ark. And when you have a particular series of mitzvahs which all lead to a certain goal, so the only mitzvah that the Rambam counted was not the particulars of the construction of the ark, but the mitzvah of providing the place in which Hashem's presence can dwell. Because that's the goal of all of that mitzvah. And that mitzvah happens to have several facets of it in order to get to that stage. You need to build a tabernacle in order to have the divine presence rest in that tabernacle. So the actual details of the construction of the materials involved, Maimonides does not count as separate mitzvahs because they're all included in the larger picture of creating the place and the structure where the divine presence can dwell. So he borrows that concept and says, the purpose of living in the land of Israel is in order to fulfill all of the mitzvahs which are fulfilled specifically there, to fulfill the purpose of our being there, to have that divine presence. It's part of a larger picture. And he says, that's why Maimonides doesn't count the mitzvah of living as a specific mitzvah, because it's included, again, it's based on the rules that you use when you divide up your count, it's included in the bigger picture of the Jewish people. Like, everyone's supposed to be living in the land of Israel. We have so many mitzvahs to do which are specific to the land of Israel. So it's not a specific mitzvah to live in the land of Israel listed separately, because that's part of a bigger picture of things that are going on within the world Jewish culture. So, of course, he learns, Maimonides agrees to Nachmanides that it's a mitzvah to sell the land of Israel. There's no discussion about that. The only discussion is about whether or not you count it as distinct mitzvahs. And that's his approach to the understanding of Maimonides, that of course Maimonides agrees in principle to the idea of it being a mitzvah. Most commentators happen to take this approach that the Rambam does agree to that. It's just that he didn't count it as a mitzvah, because if you look at his 200 pages of rules which dictate what he counts and what he didn't count, so it wasn't counted as a separate mitzvah. It's part of a larger picture. And that is the approach that he takes to that issue. But again, this is a much larger topic than what we're dealing with. These are just some of the tips of the iceberg of the discussions as to whether or not it's listed as a separate mitzvah, whether or not everybody agrees it is a mitzvah. But certainly within the 3 weeks that we're in right now, it's great just to spend some time contemplating the fact that that is such a central role, it plays such a central role to the Jewish people as the land that we are supposed to be living in, and we should eventually all get there. May it be rebuilt speedily in our days. A wonderful afternoon.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.